The court will proceed to the second case of the day, In Re Aerodyne Communications. Ms. Pamenter.
May it please the court, Catherine Pamenter on behalf of the appellants. As this court stated in Holstein versus Brill, there is a season for everything. And the season for stating the amount of a debt is before confirmation of a plan of reorganization. Here, in response to the FCC's attempt to amend its claim 6 years after the confirmation order was entered and 3 months after the 1999 case was closed, the bankruptcy court impermissibly modified a substantially consummated plan by implying post-confirmation interest. Judge Martin.
Well, a bankruptcy judge just interpreted his own plan, didn't he? Didn't modify it.
He did do a modification. Section 1127 of the Bankruptcy Code indicates that modifications of substantially consummated.
Well, I'm not asking you why it was a modification. He just said it was implicit that interest was included in the plan. That was his interpretation of his own order, wasn't it?
By stating that he was, quote, rewriting history, the bankruptcy court indicated that it was making a modification that is not permitted under the bankruptcy code.
I don't think he, where did he use the word modification?
He didn't indicate either an interpretation or a modification in his order, Your Honor. What is at issue here?
This is a pretty experienced bankruptcy judge, too.
We do. We agree. And as such, we do not appeal his decisions lightly. But in an effort to correct some perceived inequity, the principle of finality was disregarded, as was the principle that secured creditors, like the FCC, must participate in proceedings with respect to their claims or otherwise lose them. There are two issues with respect to interest before this court today. First is the district court's decision to reverse the bankruptcy court and award on its own Section 506B interest. Unlike the cases that the FCC cites, In Re Fawcett and its progeny, where a secured creditor included in its proof of claim a statement like, quote, for purposes of Section 506B of the Bankruptcy Code, post-petition interest may be payable, unquote, here, the FCC never made a request for 506B interest at any time during the 1999 case. In addition, the FCC never proved that it was oversecured. In its March 8, 2000 proof of claim, the FCC stated in box 4 the amount of the claim and box 5 the value of the collateral securing the claim, the same dollar amount.
Can I stop you for a moment? Because numbered paragraph 4 of the stipulation reserves the right of the FCC to seek the inclusion and allowance of interest on the allowed claims. Why is that stipulation not determinative? What else could it mean?
The 2006 stipulation preserved the allowed claim of the FCC and TDS. That allowed claim, which was allowed pursuant to the May 20th, 2004 allowance order, simply allowed the principal amount of $64,219,422.55. No interest was allowed pursuant to that order. The stipulation preserving that claim also simply reserved the right of the FCC and TDS to seek the inclusion of interest, and also reserve the right of Aerodyne to object to any request for interest that may have been made. All that stipulation did was simply preserve the status quo. It did not give any more rights that otherwise existed. If it were the case that that stipulation included interest, then paragraph 2 of the stipulation would have said the allowed claim of the FCC is preserved and interest is included in that claim.
You know, You refer to the 2000 plan as substantially consummated, even though the appellants never paid a single penny for the allowed claim before the 2006 bankruptcy was filed. How can the 2000 plan be considered substantially consummated?
The 2000 plan is substantially consummated because the 1999 case was closed, as well as the fact that there was created and confirmed the 2006 plan. That couldn't have happened if the 2000 plan hadn't been substantially consummated. And, in fact, there is no question. The FCC does not disagree that that plan was, in fact, substantially consummated. In terms of your question as to why is this fair, the fact of the matter is the FCC consented to this. Aerodyne tendered payment to the FCC through Section 5.1 of the plan, which states that on the reinstatement payment date, all allowed claims of the FCC shall be paid in full. Having tendered payment to the FCC, they then refused that payment by never reinstating the licenses. As of June 22, 2001, the date that the D.C. Circuit entered its decision in NextWave, the FCC knew its position was wrong with respect to NextWave. The FCC had 8 days under the 2000 plan to reinstate the licenses, and if it had done so, it would have been paid in full. But the FCC had made a policy choice here. Its choice was that it didn't want to be seen as taking a position inconsistent with the position it was taking in NextWave. NextWave involved billions of dollars. Aerodyne only involved millions of dollars. As such, it wanted to continue to be asserting its unsecured claim. And when the D.C. Circuit told them that their position was wrong, they continued with the policy choice not to reinstate Aerodyne's licenses, but rather to continue on with its assertion that the licenses had been canceled. In addition, it's also fair because the FCC never complained about not being paid. Between the time that the Supreme Court issued its decision in NextWave in January of 2003 through the date that the 1999 case was closed on June 27th of 2006, I'm not aware of any motion, request, objection, or claim that the FCC filed with the bankruptcy court with respect to non-payment. They had consented. I'm sorry.
Yeah. We have a situation that the 2000 plan did not provide for. And it's this. The licenses were restored as a result of a Supreme Court decision. If the 2000 plan didn't provide for that contingency, why shouldn't we just defer to the bankruptcy judge's interpretation of the plan? We have to fill in the gap somehow. Why isn't that a legitimate way to fill in the gaps?
The problem here is it eviscerates the principle of finality, which serves as the foundation of all bankruptcy cases. In this case, Section 5.1 discussed what the treatment of the FCC's claim would be.
Forgive me.
Yes.
Finality. When you bring up finality, you argued that the 2000 plan and the allowance order didn't provide for deferred payments of the allowed claim, and also that there was no due date, and so the payment couldn't be considered late or deferred. When no due date is specified, can Aerodyne delay payment indefinitely with no consequences?
Actually, there
shouldn't the payment have been made in a reasonable time? I mean, why are you talking about finality?
Actually, there was a due date under the 2000 plan. Section 5.1 said the due date was on the reinstatement payment date, which is the date that the FCC reinstated the licenses by a final order. As the bankruptcy judge recognized throughout this case, the FCC was in control of its own destiny here, and as such, needed to protect its claims like any other secured creditor. Here, Section 5.1 of the plan set forth the treatment with respect to the FCC's secured claim and its alternative unsecured claim. Class 1A under Section 5.1 had two sentences. The second sentence is inapplicable because it had two predicates at the buyer's option and with the FCC's consent, neither of which was satisfied. So we are left with comparing the first sentence of Section 5.1 with respect to the Class 1A claim and the Class 1B unsecured claim treatment. Both use the same language, quote, paid in full, unquote. The FCC objected with respect to the Class 1B unsecured claim treatment, comparing it to Class 7 general unsecured creditors, where the treatment was, quote, paid in full with interest at the legal rate, unquote. They recognized that paid in full did not include interest, But they chose not to object to it with respect to their secured claim, their Class 1A claim, but only their unsecured claim, their Class 1B claim. That's completely consistent with the policy choice that the SEC had made in this case, to only protect or preserve its unsecured claim and thus accept the terms of the plan with respect to its secured claim.
Well, I mean, a creditor is entitled by statute to both types of interest. And even though it wasn't clear at the time of the 2000 plan confirmation that the FCC was a secured creditor, it later became apparent that it had been all along. And, you know, that's the reasoning, of course, that the district court allowed the FCC to recover the pre-confirmation interest as well.
If you'll allow me to talk about both kinds of interest, I had started off earlier explaining Section 506B interest. In there, there's two requirements. First, that a timely request be made, as this court's decision was set forth in Chappelle. There's been no request throughout the entire 1999 case for interest, and as such, it cannot be seen to have been timely, to have been made for the first time on September 11th of 2006. Second, the FCC needed to prove that it was oversecured. In its March 8th, 2000 proof of claim, in box 4, the amount of the claim, and box 5, the value of the collateral securing the claim, the FCC set forth the same dollar amount. It didn't assert oversecurity at all. During the 2000 plan confirmation hearing, in response to Mr. Galley's testimony, which the FCC cites too heavily in its brief, Mr. Miller, the FCC's counsel, objected to Mr. Galley's testimony, quote, to the extent it seeks to value the licenses currently, unquote, at FCC Appendix page 36, lines 6 through 8. Further, in the brief that the FCC filed with this court at page 10, the FCC admits that the court, quote, had not decided whether the licenses restored to Aerodyne would be of a value sufficient to fully secure the FCC's related claim, unquote. So the two requirements that the FCC indicate make a timely request and also that it show that it is oversecured were not met. The district court acted improperly in reversing the bankruptcy court and on its own awarding Section 506B interest. Turning to post-confirmation interest, as we've set forth in our briefs, there are three reasons why that decision was improper. First and foremost is the issue of res judicata. In this court's decision in Matter of Pence, the court recognized that the FCC, like every creditor, was required to follow the administration of the estate and determine what aspects of the proceedings it wanted to challenge. As in Matter of Pence, the FCC was not permitted to stick its head in the sand and pretend only to participate in the proceedings as an unsecured creditor and thus not protect any claim that it had as a secured creditor. In its proof of claim, it asserted in the alternative an unsecured claim and a secured claim. It knew it might be wrong in the position that it was taking with respect to the licenses, and as such had a duty to protect, to make whatever objection it felt was appropriate with respect to the 2000 plan. Finality governs with respect to bankruptcy cases. Otherwise, bankruptcy doesn't work. Here, though, the FCC has now decided to say, oops, we were wrong. We took the wrong position back in 1999. We really are a secured creditor. We should have protected our interest as a secured creditor back in 2000. We were wrong, but pay us post-confirmation interest anyways. That's not how bankruptcy can work. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Clare?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jeffrey Clare. I'm Justice Department Counsel for the FCC. Your Honor, when the bankruptcy court approved the 2000 plan of reorganization, it knew two things. It knew first that the code requires a secured creditor who has objected to the plan to be paid interest if the payments under that plan are to be deferred or delayed. And it knew secondly that there was testimony from Aerodyne's chief executive officer as well as comments from Aerodyne's counsel at the confirmation hearing offered in support of confirming the plan that Aerodyne had proposed, that if the licenses were restored to the estate, that the FCC would become a secured creditor and that it would be paid in full under this plan, including payments with interest.
You know, you drafted the allowance order. You didn't include interest. Why shouldn't the court construe the allowance order against the FCC as drafter?
Well, Your Honor, in terms of the amounts that were due as of the petition date, we've abandoned our appeal of that interest. But the allowance order, by the terms of Section 502 of the Code, is expressly limited to the amount of the claim and interest accrued up to the point of point of commencement of the case, not with respect to post-confirmation interest or interest that is due in the interim period between commencement of the case.
So what's the difference between what you've dropped on appeal and what you haven't dropped on appeal in actual dollars and cents? Of course, it's moving along, isn't it?
There's about $30 million and $31 million on appeal and about another $11, $12 million in interest that is not contested.
So you've dropped the 11 to 12?
Yes. Some of that includes a claim that the appellants and cross-appellees have also dropped. But most of that is pre-petition interest that the lower courts held should have been included in that 2004 allowance order, wasn't included, and we've dismissed.
You've eaten it, basically.
That would be one way of putting it.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. But in terms of the whether interest is required by the plan that the bankruptcy court confirmed in 2000, the post-confirmation interest, the bankruptcy court knew that such interest must be provided under the code where the plan is not confirmable, and it had what it understood from the record as representations from the debtor and the debtor's counsel that if the FCC restored the licenses and the FCC became a secured creditor, interest would be paid. So when this issue was again presented to the district court, it construed its own order as implicitly recognizing that interest on that 2000 post-confirmation interest on the 2000 plan must be paid. There are ample grounds for that determination in the record before the court. It is consistent with the
Your position is the bankruptcy judge interpreted the plan and the order, and we should defer to his interpretation.
That is our position in part, yes, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we defer to it in the 506 branch, too?
Well, the district court disagreed and reversed because it found...
Well, sure it did, but why should we disagree?
Well, again, because, Your Honor, the Supreme Court case law makes clear that once a creditor has a secured claim and identifies himself as a secured creditor and is found to be a secured creditor, they are entitled by operation of the code to interest to the extent of any security cushion they have running from the commencement of the petition through the confirmation of the plan. That's part of what it means to be an allowed claim. Now, there is the contention that this claim was waived because it was not expressly identified in the claim that the FCC submitted. This court, however, has expressly reserved the question of whether a creditor must put forward such an express demand in its
claim. Well, I don't see any good reason why we should defer to the bankruptcy judge in one instance and not the other.
Well, again, Your Honor, at least in part, the argument for deference is the court's understanding of what the code requires. And in both instances, the code makes clear that this interest is part and parcel of the secured creditor's claim. The central objection to this from appellants is the principles of res judicata and finality. Certainly when an order is confirmed, there are important reliance interests in ensuring that the order not be lightly disturbed, and the principle that it sometimes is more important that the law be settled than the law be settled correctly sometimes obtains. Not in this context, however. The court in the Escobedo decision has made clear that if a plan does not comply with mandatory requirements of the code, it does not have res judicata effect. So the sole question in this area is there a mandatory code requirement that a secured creditor be paid interest if it's subjected to the plan and if distributions under the plan are to be delayed? And the answer to that is an emphatic yes. The text of Section 1129b2 makes that clear. I've sent the court a 28J letter, including a Supreme Court case and a case from the Ninth Circuit, both of which, in discussing the requirements of cram down on an objecting secured creditor, make clear that interest on a claim must be paid or the plan is not confirmable. That really should be the end of the matter there. There is no res judicata impact to a plan that is confirmed without complying with this requirement. Even if there were, there is this matter of the stipulation. The case stayed open. The 1999/2000 case stayed open for some time. It was still open in 2006 when the debtor filed a second reorganization request. Why? Because it felt that it had to revise the terms of the plan, that it could no longer be carried forth in full. And it was the debtor that sought to reopen matters that had been previously settled by the 2000 plan of confirmation. The FCC initially objected, citing some of the same principles that appellants have cited here, that you're not supposed to have serial bankruptcy proceedings. If there's a problem with the case, you're supposed to deal with it in that case, not close it out and start a new one. And the parties eventually reached a stipulation, and it is the stipulation Your Honor quoted. It's at page 130 of the FATR appendix, the FCC supplemental appendix, that makes clear that the FCC's right to seek interest on the claim allowed in the prior case is reserved. Now, what can that mean? I think it does mean that the parties are reserving substantive objections to the claim. It is not a concession certainly we're not maintaining that it's a concession by the debtor that there is a substantive entitlement to interest. But it is a concession that the claim can properly be raised and asserted in the case. Well, the essence of res judicata is that claims cannot be asserted, that they are barred independent of their merits. So when you have the debtor entering to this stipulation as the kind of quid pro quo for allowing a new case to be started, what can that possibly mean other than that the debtor recognizes that interest on the claim can continue to be asserted? If I might turn briefly back to the Section 506B question, this is the code provision that provides that an oversecured creditor can get interest as a running again from the commencement of the case to the confirmation of the plan. We've cited some Supreme Court and other appellate authority for the proposition that this is really an integral part of an allowed claim. There is the contention that the FCC waived the claim by not asking for it expressly in the claim that was submitted. It is the more prudent practice to identify the interest request, but it is not a required practice. The FCC clearly, I think it has been conceded, clearly identified itself as a secured creditor. Most parties
expect... That claim was discharged, though, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Wasn't that claim discharged?
Well, the claim the stipulation preserves the right to demand interest in the subsequent case. The case had not been closed at the time of the stipulation, and one of the things the code allows you to do in an open case is, to the extent matters have not already been dealt with satisfactorily in an allowed claim, it allows the creditor to seek reconsideration of the allowance order. That's in Rule 3008 of the Bankruptcy Code.
Isn't that what the bankruptcy court held, though, that it was discharged?
Well, I think my understanding of the bankruptcy court's holding, Your Honor, is that the claim had ineffectively been waived and the matter had been settled. I'm not sure that I don't understand the court to say that it has been discharged so much as it has been waived. And either of that, the bankruptcy court did hold that there was no entitlement to it in light of the FCC's actions. The district court, applying some of the same reasoning that it applied to the other interest question, recognized again that on the record, the debtor at the confirmation hearing had indicated that secured claims would be paid with interest, and that again is a requirement of the code.
Would I be wrong if I thought that, in essence, the bankruptcy court was saying it was too late to be asking for that interest in the 2006 bankruptcy?
I think that's what the court was saying, yes.
But then, of course, the district court felt that there wasn't any meaningful distinction.
Yes, between the two.
Between the two. And,
No, again, Your Honor, you have in 2006, you have a situation where the case is not over. The case is still open. The plan's been confirmed, and there is a contention that it's been substantially consummated, but substantially consummated is a term of art under the code, and it doesn't mean that the transactions have progressed so far that they can't be unwound. It means that property identified in the plan is vested in the debtor and that distributions have commenced. Well, in this case, the FCC has never been paid. The FCC is one of the two largest creditors. The other largest creditor, TDS, they weren't paid either. Where are the reliance interests here? There were contemplations of certain payments under the 2000 plan, but the payments had never been effectuated. Our reliance interest, we'd say, what reliance interest? On the facts of the case, how is it that the parties really relied on the finality of the 2000 plan? It simply is not borne out by the record. At that juncture, the FCC, in light of the lack of any practical finality, could have sought reconsideration of the claim, could have made other requests to the court to provide this interest. And the way the parties dealt with it was to agree that interest could be sought in the new case. That's the purpose of the stipulation.
Is the interest still rolling along as we sit here?
On the 506B interest is closed. It runs from the commencement of the case through the confirmation of the 2000 plan, only to the extent of the security cushion, to the excess and the collateral. The plan confirmation interest runs from the confirmation of the 2000 plan to the commencement of the 2006 proceeding. If Your Honor has asked me whether there is interest on top of that interest, I do not know. I'm not sure of the answer to that question, Your Honor.
Can you explain the effect of the Supreme Court's decision in Next Wave on the licenses? In other words, were the licenses considered restored after New Wave, or was the legal effect of Next Wave that the licenses had never been canceled in the first place and that the cancellation had been ineffective?
Well, Your Honor, with respect, I believe you've already answered that question in the first Aerodyne case, where the court made clear in its holding that Next Wave indicated that the cancellation was in effect void ab initio.
So I'm trying to find out your thoughts on it, you see.
My thoughts, Your Honor, are that we're bound by the court's holding in that regard, and it's just not open for us to make any further argument to the court about that. As a practical matter, as a practical matter, I think that both lower courts really understood the practical realities of the situation, was that this was a plan there where all the parties and the court were under the misimpression that the licenses had validly canceled, and all the options in the plan dealt with only that contingency and left a kind of gaping hole as to what might happen and what actually did happen, which is that the initial cancellation could be declared invalid and the licenses would be deemed to have been part of the estate all along, but there was no provision in the plan that dealt with them. And that is why the bankruptcy court felt that the most equitable thing to do and the fairest understanding of its own confirmation order was that to the extent the SEC once again became a secured creditor, interest would be paid on the secured claim.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
First, with respect to Escobedo, that case is inapposite in this case. Escobedo dealt with Section 1322 of the Bankruptcy Code in terms of the contents of a Chapter 13 plan. Section 1123 of the Bankruptcy Code, the counterpart in Chapter 11, is not at issue in this case. What is at issue is Section 1129B of the Bankruptcy Code. That provides that a plan shall be confirmed if it does not discriminate unfairly and is fair and equitable. That language is akin to the language in Section 1325 that we discussed with respect to Sozick and Shove. It's not what is mandatory is that the bankruptcy court make a finding that the plan not discriminate unfairly and is fair and equitable. The bankruptcy court has several alternatives in terms of how to accomplish that. 11 U.S.C. Section 1129B2 uses the word includes. As such, the bankruptcy court has the ability to determine if a plan is fair and equitable, including if the secured creditor chooses for policy reasons to decide not to assert any claim for interest. Once that finding that the plan is fair and equitable is made, and it is not appealed, it may...
a mandatory provision?
It's not a mandatory provision. Like Section 1325, it states the plan shall be confirmed if. It doesn't say only if, and the courts in Sozick and Shove have recognized that distinction, as has this court in Escobedo. If I may just finish briefly on this point, Your Honor, despite the red light.
Sure.
The bankruptcy court, as I indicated, made a finding in 2000 that the plan was fair and equitable. To the extent the FCC believed that finding was improper, it needed to appeal it within the 10-day appeal time. It did not do so. As a result, that decision is final. The bankruptcy court did not interpret its plan because there was no ambiguity in the plan. It didn't provide for interest on the FCC's secured or unsecured claim. As such, the modification was improper. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.